About 7 years ago, we got around to that time and were most chagrined to discover that that year the best-selling book in the world had been Mao's Little Red Book. And most of the years since then, it has been the bestseller, and the Bible has been second best. In spite of that, we tend, by and large, to ignore it. And in spite of the fact that communism is continuing to spread across the world, we who live in the part of the world that isn't communist, for the most part, tend to ignore it as though it's going to go away if we don't pay any attention to it, instead of taking a look at it, seeing what it has to say, and seeing in what respects it does represent a threat to us, because it is a very obvious threat to us, both politically and theologically. So, it's a book that has to be reckoned with, and Chinese communism, as I mentioned at the end of the last period, has been highly successful in areas of the world where the Russian variety of communism has been almost without success or totally unsuccessful. It is, as I say, the most influential book in the world today. There are probably better than 1 billion people in the world who are familiar with the book, and most of them read it every day as devoutly as Christians read their Bibles. I was over in Europe in 1968 at the time of the student Paris uprising. I got into Paris about 4 days after finally Paris was cleared for people to come in. You could still smell the tear gas in the streets, and there were a lot of the main boulevards that weren't open because the students had torn up the cobblestones from the streets and used them either to build barricades or to throw them at the police, and they had to put them back down again. And I went over to the Sorbonne, which is where it had all started. And I went over to the Sorbonne to see what was going on and whether there was anybody around. The Sorbonne had been closed for better than a month as a result of student protests. And there were a lot of students around, and everybody had a copy of Mao's Little Red Book sticking out of his back pocket. Now, I suspect that some of them were communists, many of them weren't, but they were all reading Mao's Little Red Book, and it was their strategy book. This was about the beginning of the popularity of Mao's book. I don't think, I got to Berkeley, and in the next year he went over to Caltech or Berkeley campus. It was rather easy to find Mao's Little Red Book, and then it kind of got to be a sort of an in thing on liberal campuses. One way that you showed that you were a liberal student, you know, a with it student, was by owning a copy of Chairman Mao. You may even have opened the book and looked at it. Oftentimes, Americans, including American students, are more concerned with the appearance than with the substance of the thing. But anyway, it was available in all of the bookstores. Since that time, it has sort of gotten accepted, and anything which is accepted and it is no longer feared, you know, begins to lose its popularity. But it is a collection of little saying statements, a few paragraphs, from various of the writings of Mao Zedong, dating from about the year 1926 is the earliest one, to the last one, which is in 1957, or 1964 is the last one. There is an increasing amount of the writings of Mao Zedong available in the United States. One of the interesting things about it is the documents which are most available are Mao Zedong's documents on guerrilla warfare. And they have been translated and published by retired Army officers. So indirectly, the United States Army has been spreading Mao Zedong's writings around the United States. His political thought and his economic thought is pretty much still in Chinese. But in the Little Red Book, we have a kind of a distillation of Mao's thinking. It is gathered together under 33 topic headings, and there's no particular order or organization. It's a little statement, and then after it'll say what the name of the speech or the article was and what year it appeared, and so it'll go on. Now there's a definite reason for this sort of thing, other than that it's a rather inexpensive way to get some information around, and it's also rather easy reading for people. Apart from that, it is a deliberate copy of a technique which purely by accident came into being, and that is, it is a copy of the way in which the writings of Confucius are available to the Chinese people. Confucius, the writings of Confucius in Chinese literature are about comparable to what would be the case among Lutherans if all that was available of Martin Luther was the table talk. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with the writings of Martin Luther, the table talk is little stories, jokes, pithy remarks, and so on, that Martin Luther is supposed to have said at some time or other, sitting around the table talking with his friends. And various of his friends gathered these little anecdotes together and preserved them for posterity. So it's secondhand sources. Well, all of the material of Confucius is secondhand sources. It's little stories, little statements, little events, and so on, gathered by the pupils of Confucius. Confucius never wrote any books, but his pupils gathered his sayings. So what we have here is the sayings of Mao Zedong. And you can imagine the impact that would have for the Chinese people. Mao Zedong is being analogized to Confucius. And Confucius is an extremely powerful figure in China today. Now, Confucius lived about 6 centuries before Christ. You know, he's not around today. But his thinking shaped the Chinese mentality, and it shaped it so successfully that within the last several years, the mainland Chinese communist government made a deliberate effort to wipe out Confucian thought in China. And they spent over 2 years attempting to wipe out the effect of Confucius. They attempted to get rid of the writings of Confucius. They told everybody that Confucius was a bad guy, he was a reactionary, and so on. And they finally gave it up after 2 years. It didn't work. Confucius was so embedded in the Chinese mentality and the Chinese way of seeing things that they weren't able to eradicate, and they simply gave up. Well, so in this little red book, you have something that looks sort of like the way the writings of Confucius would be. And it's deliberately done that way. And of course, we in the Western world can't begin to appreciate that because, you know, most people have never read Confucius. But it purports to be a sort of wisdom literature. In our kind of general experience, I suppose about the closest thing that there is to this kind of writing and the kind of writing of Confucius would be Proverbs in the Old Testament, Book of Proverbs, or the Book of Ecclesiastes, or the Wise Man. Now, where you have kind of talking about this topic and talking about that topic, but not in any kind of organized, disciplined kind of way. It's wisdom literature. Or it's sort of comparable to some extent of our aphorisms, you know, like a stitch in time saves nine, birds of a feather flock together. If we had a whole bunch of these sorts of things put together in a book, it's sort of parallel to that. Now, when the book came out, the the procedure which was recommended was that when one got up in the morning, one was to open Chairman Mao's book and pick out one of the statements and then meditate on that all day long. Think about that. Or if one was in a communist cadre, the group would get together and they would simply share with one another the meaning for their life that they saw in that statement. And this was the way in which the Chinese people and people around the world would be indoctrinated in Chinese communist thinking and ideology. All right, now last time I talked about Marx and his notion of dialectical materialism, the sorts of things which Lenin had to do, the sorts of things which Stalin had to do to the original theory in order to make it fit the times and satisfy the aspirations of the people who were waiting for the communist stateless society where everything went perfectly well for everybody and there wasn't any more change. You know, they kept saying, when's it going to come? When's it going to come? Why is this going on? Why is that going on? And the sorts of answers they had to give to satisfy people. It's sort of like what Vern was talking about this morning, where you have this kind of doctrine and you have this kind of state of affairs, and how do you reconcile the two to one another? All right, now, Mao Zedong comes along, and there are certain ideas which are unique to him, certain contributions which he makes. There's one theoretic problem with the communistic approach, an explanation of history, and that is it begins with the idea of this endless dialectic of opposites coming along, you remember. But all of a sudden, we get the dictatorship of the proletariat, and we get rid of private property, and we get rid of classes, and whoopee, the dialectic ends. Well, that's not good logic. The dialectic should keep on going somehow or other, because the nature of experience is change. The nature of change is the dialectic. How can you have a time when there's no change? Well, Mao realized that that was the case, and so he said, there is no end to the dialectic. The dialectic goes on forever. Now, Mao also realized, as Lenin and Stalin may have also, but they didn't dare say it because it would contradict the way that they had operated. But Mao very much realized that according to Marxist theory, it was inevitable that the capitalistic stage would pass away and would be replaced by what he liked to call the socialistic stage. And, you know, this is the way it's going to be. Well, if that's the way it's going to be, and if history is on the side of the communist movement, so why stir up trouble? You know, why fight? Why have revolutions? Just sit back and wait for it to come. So the very idea of violent revolution is logically incompatible with the idea of the dialectic of history and the inevitability of communism. And it's a vulnerable point that has tended not to be exploited by anti-communists. But Mao was very much aware of it. And while he at least talked about the necessity of revolution, violent revolution, at least until his party got in power in China, he was very much aware of the fact that the idea of violence, you know, mass violence, is incompatible. That if you believe that nature is more powerful than mankind, and that inevitably nature will have her way, and nature has determined that communism is going to replace capitalism, why fight? It's going to happen, see? And so to be a violent revolutionary is not to believe the doctrine, rather than to be a firm believer in the doctrine. And so consequently, he realized this. A few quotations. Did you come equipped, Jerry?
I'm equipped.
Page 24. Here we'll get the image of the wheel, I think. Right in the middle. Social system, page 24.
A socialist system will eventually replace a capitalistic system. This is an objective law independent of man's will.
See, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. Okay?
However, much of the reactionaries try to hold back the wheel of history. Sooner or later, revolution will take place and will inevitably triumph.
All right, now there you see the image of the wheel of history that I was using yesterday. And the capitalists, they all try to hold the wheel back and keep it from progressing, but inevitably that wheel is going to turn over and communism is going to triumph over capitalism. Well, if that's the case, why fight about it? Okay, now, on the point that there is no end to the dialectic, page 9, Jerry, at the top, he says, talks about contradiction, you know, these antagonisms back and forth. It is as a result of a contradiction between the old and the new that we get progress, that life moves on, that society gets better. If there's no antagonism, if there's no contradictions, if there are no internal frictions, things don't move on. In a sense, I suppose what he's saying is, if you sit here this morning and your seat's very, very comfortable, you're just going to keep on sitting. But if there's a tack down there and it starts bothering you and so on, you know, then you'll move and do something. And so there has to be this kind of friction in society, or society gets reactionary or set in its ways. It gets in a rut. And so there has to be the constant ongoing dialectic, and this is why, so I'll point out either later on today or tomorrow, every once in a while you got to stir up the pot. Your fire burns low here in the fireplace, and every once in a while you got to go and shake it up so that the flames stir up again. And so every once in a while you got to shake loose the whole system, so that it gets out of being set in its ways and the wheel moves forward. And so Mao says, you know, this settling down and peace and quiet and the lion lying down with the lamb and no more wars or anything else like that, it's all fantasy. The nature of life is change, and we will keep on going. Now, he doesn't say that communist society is a stage, and then there'll be something after communism, and then there'll be something after that, and then there'll be something after that. Now, it's implied by what he says, but he's a good Marxist, and so he doesn't say anything like that. But he is aware of the fact that if change is the way things are, that a communist kind of society is simply a way station on the progress of human relationships. It's not the end of the line. Poland, another thing which he introduces, and which certainly was necessary by the time he came along, is the idea of patience as a virtue. Mao was a communist already in the late 20s, the middle 20s. He was born in 1893 in December, which means that this year in December he will be 82. He lives that long. And already in the 20s he was a communist. Interesting to trace the background of the men who were and who are leaders in China, because in the 20s and 30s, early 30s, Chiang Kai-shek was the top dog at the Chinese Military Academy, the Wang Po Academy, the Chinese equivalent of West Point. So he was like the commandant of West Point. Chou Enlai was one of the instructors there. Mao Zedong was one of the instructors there. And I think Lin Piao also, who was who was done away with a few years ago because he tried to topple Mao Zedong and take over. And by the way, the introduction in the first edition is written by Chairman Mao's good friend Lin Piao. I suspect that, is that in yours, Jerry? I suspect that's not in any longer. But the introduction at the very beginning was, well, there's just a little statement. You got a little statement like this on the back of a page of Chinese writing?
No.
See, there's a statement by Lin Piao, which, for those of you that can't read Chinese, which includes me, it says, study Chairman Mao's writings, follow his teachings, and act according to his instructions. Well, see, this was at the time when Lin Piao was expected to be Mao Zedong's successor.
He's I not, have 72 edition.
Yeah, well, see, he's no longer in there because he he tried to take over before the chairman had died. Also, apparently, two or three times attempted to assassinate him. Maybe he was working for the CIA all along. We never knew. Well, anyway, all of these guys knew one another back in the 20s and early 30s and had a falling out at the Wang Po Academy. They fought against one another, and Mao Zedong and his followers lost, and they retreated way back into the back recesses of China, almost 6,000 miles that they went on foot to escape the Nationalist Army. Then came World War II, and they both fought against the Japanese, whom the Chinese have always hated. And then after World War II, they fought again, and we had equipped both sides with weapons during World War II, and so the communists used our weapons to defeat Chiang Kai-shek and got control of the government. All right, so much for that. Well, anyway, you have to have patience, and Mao certainly learned a lot of patience because he waited for better than 30 years to get control of the government. Well, there's a very famous story which he tells entitled The Foolish Old Man Who Removed the Mountains, and it always works well here in the Holden Village setting, particularly for people like Vern that were out hiking yesterday and are still aching today. The Foolish Old Man Who Removed the Mountains. There was an old man who lived in northern China a long time ago, and they called him the Foolish Old Man of North Mountain. His house faced to the south, and beyond his doorway stood two great peaks, Taihang and Wang Wu. And it would be about like if you were sitting here looking that way, and there's Buckskin and Coppers. Two great peaks faced him, Taihang and Wang Wu, and they were in the way. So he decided he was going to remove them. So he took his sons out to the mountains, hoe in hand. They're going to get rid of the mountains. Well, he was an old man, and another old man came up to him and said, "You foolish old man, it's impossible for the few of you to dig up those huge mountains." And the old man said, "When I die, my sons will carry on, and when they die, there will be my grandsons, and then their sons, and their grandsons, and so on. High as they are, the mountains aren't going to grow any higher." Now, I suspect Larry would tell us they're still growing, right? Because these are still young mountains. Okay, well, maybe the mountains in China don't grow. Okay, but anyway, he says, "High as they are, these mountains aren't going to grow any higher, but my sons and grandsons and so on will keep on digging, and so eventually those mountains are going to be gone." He never knew about glacier action, did he? Okay. Well, it says God felt sorry. It's interesting to see how many times in the writings of Mao Zedong for an atheist to communist, how many times he quotes God. God felt sorry for this old man, admired his gumption, and he sent down two angels who carried the mountains away on their back. And so then he makes the application. He says, there are today two great mountains that lie like a dead weight on the Chinese people. One is imperialism, you know, that's foreigners exploiting China for their own advantage. The other one is feudalism. The Chinese warlords run the country for their own benefit. The Chinese Communist Party long ago has made up its mind to dig them up, and if it persists at this task and has patience long enough, it's going to complete the task. Because imperialism and feudalism aren't going to get any stronger, but the Communist Party will. And so this idea of waiting out the other guy, sticking with it, keep on doing it, the whole notion of Oriental patience is extremely important and has become one of the basic kinds of values in the way Communist parties the world round are operating today. I think the Russians still are rather impatient, but many of the nationalistic Communist parties are just kind of hanging in there. So they lost this election, so maybe they'll win the next one. So they lose the next one, well, maybe they'll win the next one. And so they just try to outsit the opposition and don't get disturbed by any kind of reverses. We know what happened in Vietnam, where the Oriental people are still trying to figure out, you know, what happened to our patience. Why didn't we hang in there? And how come you quit? We say, well, it's the longest war we ever fought. What difference does that make? You hang in there until you win. And this idea of patience, outlasting the other guy, is an extremely important idea, and we Americans who are very impatient certainly need to learn it if we expect to outlast the opposition. Number three, confidence in the masses of people. Now, this is an extremely important idea in Mao Zedong. In any writing of Mao that you read, sooner or later, he will refer to the masses. Confidence in the masses. Now, I suspect that this idea of confidence in the masses grows out of two factors. One, the Chinese people are a very large group of people, 800 some million people, who have preserved a folk culture for probably between 3 and 4,000 years. They've preserved a folk culture relatively intact. And this culture is largely an oral culture. You take it in with your mother's milk when you're a Chinese child. And whether you are a peasant's child or whether you are a top level class child, you absorb the Chinese culture and refine it. And the Chinese tradition of manners, ways of doing things. And so consequently the values are just sort of preserved in the people. They're not preserved by the intellectuals or by the government or by the schools. They're in the people. And so consequently in the final analysis, when you have a problem and you're not sure what to do, Mao always says you go to the people to find out how the people feel about things. One of the political theorists whom Mao Zedong admires more than any other political theorist is Thomas Jefferson. Because Thomas Jefferson, in most of his political writings, emphasized government exists to express and to bring into being the will of the people. And government must always go to the people to find out what they want. Well, that Mao Zedong liked. All right, that's one side. Secondly, Mao Zedong could never have survived had it not been for the Chinese people. Because when he and his followers were on the run, it was fellow Chinese who took them in and provided them with food and protected them, and who gave them camouflage, you know, and who told the nationalist troops when they came by. He went that away when he was hiding up in the attic. And so he knew that no government could survive if it did not have the people on its side. And he also knew that Chiang Kai-shek did not have the people on his side. And so he had to maintain himself in power by means of his army. Same thing was true in Taiwan. So it was by means of his army that he remained in power, but he didn't have the people on his side. And so consequently, Mao was supremely confident that he was eventually going to win because the peasants accepted him. Now, Mao came from a peasant family. And but at the same time, Mao Zedong was and is a peasant. You know, like Abraham Lincoln was a log splitter. You do not successfully prosecute a civil war on the basis of your log splitting ability. It takes more than that to be president of the United States. And so, while Abraham Lincoln came from a poverty-stricken childhood to become president of the United States, Mao Zedong came from a peasant family. But he was a brilliant young man, and he advanced very rapidly through the educational system of China, and was a fairly top person. He was not one of the upper crust blue blood Chinese relatives of Sun Yat-sen. Chiang Kai-shek was, by virtue of having married Sun Yat-sen's youngest daughter. You know, he married into power in China. And so the people identified with Mao, and they didn't identify with Chiang Kai-shek, nor was Chiang Kai-shek interested in being identified with, because he considered himself better than the people. It was dying day. And so consequently, Mao always emphasized, stay close to the people. Have the people on your side. Number four, he changed some of the terms, some because they didn't fit Chinese culture, and some because he had terms that sounded less pejorative than the ones which were being used. Like, for instance, Marx had talked about the dictatorship of the proletariat. That you must overthrow the bourgeoisie capitalist government and set up a dictatorship of proletarian people. Well, by the time Mao comes along, the idea of a dictatorship is not a very good word. So call your government a dictatorship is a dirty word. The good sounding word is democracy. And so instead of saying you must overthrow the government and establish the dictatorship of the proletariat, he talks about our first stage must be a democratic revolution. I see how much better that sounds. The Democrats, you do the same thing, only you get a different term for it. You have a democratic revolution. Marx had said that after a while the need for a state will disappear and then the state will wither away. Mao wasn't that confident that it was just going to plain wither away, and he knew the tenacity of states. And so he says the second thing which has to happen is we have a socialist revolution. Marx talked about disagreements between people. Mao talks about contradictions. Contradictions emerge. Very objective. Contradictions emerge. Let's say people don't get along with one another. Just a contradictory situation has emerged here. You see how much better it sounds. It's the same thing, only it sounds better. Marx talked about the proletariat. Mao uses that term once in a while, but he usually talks about the masses, the people. It sounds better. Proletariat sounds too technical and clinical. And, you know, the people sounds much better. He also did this because there were virtually no proletarians in China. Really, the only proletarians that existed in China when Mao took over were the coolies. The coolies were the men who unloaded and loaded ships in Shanghai and the other seaports. And about all that they possessed was a few clothes that they had on their back and the little pad that they put on their head between their head and the packages that they carried on their heads, you know, and then a mat of reeds that they curled up on and slept at night, and they got, we still use the term today, coolie wages, you know, they got next to nothing. And they lived from one day to the next on what they made. Those were the only proletarians in China. Everybody else was either a big landowner, a warlord, you know, politician, big-time politician, or peasant. And every peasant owned a little plot of ground. So the only proletarians were maybe 5,000 or 6,000 coolies in all of China. See, you know, it's a term you can't use to it. They didn't have big factories or anything else like that with wage slaves. So the term proletarian wasn't particularly meaningful among the Chinese. And finally, he introduced the idea that periodically you have to overturn your system, your structure. Now, Mao believed that man is by nature a kind of orderly being, and that in order to solve problems, he will organize and produce structures. In this way, the Chinese are like the Americans. And you know, we have the old American saying, I think I've quoted here upon occasion, where two or three are gathered together, there one of them is being elected president. you know, whenever we get a group of people together, immediately we form a new organization and elect officers and a committee to write the Constitution. We organize. And the Chinese are the same way. They organize. They have a job they got to do. They get it organized. And they do it. And So Mao felt it's in the nature of the human critter to organize. At the same time, organizations tend to outlive their usefulness. And so consequently, periodically, we got to knock the whole business loose and get rid of all of these organizations that are no longer serving any useful function and then reorganize. And so this is why every once in a while he'd have himself a cultural revolution. And he'd get the teenagers, you know, teenagers are terrific at destroying order, aren't they? Anybody that's got teenagers knows that. There are again rules. Why do there have to be rules, and why do people have to go to bed at night? And why do people have to get up in the morning? Right? So we, you know, you shake the bars of the cage that imprisons you. And so he would unleash these canters of red guards, and they'd go out and they'd just rip everything up in sight, and they'd knock out this and they'd knock out that, and they'd insult political leaders, and the whole thing just got all shook up, and they had to rethink the situation, reorganize the situation, and the thing that was obsolete out, it went. So this kind of an idea he introduced. Now this idea does not seem to have been too popular in China. I can't imagine many countries where it would be particularly popular, but certainly not in China, because China for thousands of years has been one vast bureaucracy, which I suspect is one reason why communism was successful. Soviet Union was also a vast bureaucracy, so I've always personally kind of felt that the best security the United States could have against becoming communist would be to dismantle our bureaucracy, because communism seems to need a bureaucracy in order to take over and survive, you know, in a government. So, at any rate, the Chinese don't seem to have been too happy about that, because about a year and a half ago, Mao called out the Red Guards again to have another cultural revolution. I guess he figured he needed one more before he died. So he called out the Red Guards, And the army came out and they arrested them all and stuck them in jail and says, all right, you kids, get back home. And the kids all went back home, and that was the end of the Cultural Revolution. And Mao's been pretty quiet ever since. But you know, the one that was about 10 years ago, really, 10, 12 years ago, it just, you know, it set China back 5, 10 years. With everything, you know, the whole country was in turmoil. And deliberately did it to, you know, shake loose some new ideas and get things better. You know, the boys running the show were getting a little complacent, so we had to shake them all up every once in a while. Okay, well, last time he got shook. All right, now let me go back just a moment to this notion about confidence in the masses, because there's another important point about this having confidence in the masses of the people. Lenin had taught, and some of these ideas he sort of got from Marx, but Lenin had taught that while there was to be a proletarian revolution, it would have to be led by the intellectuals, because the proletariat were too dumb. They were uneducated. They don't know what the score is. So they have to have intellectuals who come out of the bourgeoisie class, you know, but don't really fit the bourgeoisie class. So the intellectuals had to lead them. The intellectual aristocrats would lead the proletariat and show them how to operate and educate them and so on. And so it just so happened that Lenin happened to be an intellectual. That's an interesting coincidence. And so the intellectuals would have to lead the proletariat. Now, Mao really disagrees with that kind of idea. And Mao says, no, the ones who really know what's good for man, the ones who kind of just naturally out of their guts have a feeling for what's right are the people. The common man. He knows what's good for him. He may not be able to articulate it like the scholar at the university. He may not be able to write a book about it. But he knows. And he has an instinctive feel for what's right and what's good for the country. And so you've always got to stay close to him. And, you know, forget this intellectual aristocratic garbage, you know, about them having to lead. It's the people. Who know? What the intellectuals got to do is set up the organization, the apparatus, to carry out the will of the masses. All right, now, I've noted down, and we'll get through these by the end of tomorrow, I've noted down 8 kind of themes which are in Mao. And we've got time for maybe one of these. Jerry 75. It's 75 and 140. I'll talk a little bit while you're hunting it up.
That's 75.
Okay, now I get 142. There's a supreme confidence that history is on the side of the communistic movement, and that things are going to work out their way. At the same time, there is a supreme belief that those who seem to be extremely powerful really aren't, and are going to be overthrown. There's an interesting analogy to this and to a number of the Old Testament writers, particularly those who write against Assyria. And they write against Assyria when Assyria is at the peak of her power. And they say, you're going to be overthrown, you're going to be destroyed, you're going to be killed, man, woman, and child. There will be nothing left of your empire. You know, everybody says, ha, 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 you know. Well, they've been drinking late. And 30, 40 years later, Assyria is totally wiped out and gone. And totally destroyed. And the Babylonians killed them off, man, woman, and child. They're gone. There's not too much left even of the ruins of Nineveh, which was their big city that possibly had as many as 3 or 4 million people. And that extended for about 20 miles along the river. You know, just very little left there. So Mao is making his predictions about his enemies, and the particular enemy that he was writing about was the United States of America, because the United States of America is the big power. And what does he say, Jerry? Just take the end of the last three sentences of the top quote on 75.
Start beginning about the Tsar of Russia.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let's start with Hitler.
Okay.
Let's start with Hitler.
Was not Hitler a paper tiger? Was Hitler not overthrown? I also said the Tsar of Russia, the Emperor of China, and Japanese imperialism were all paper tigers. As we know, they were all overthrown. U.S. imperialism has not yet been overthrown, and it has the atom bomb. I believe it will be overthrown. It, too, is a paper tiger.
Okay, and then on 140, he points out that the atom bomb is the paper tiger which U.S. reactionaries use to scare people. It looks terrible, but in fact it isn't. Of course, the atom bomb is a weapon of mass slaughter. But the outcome of a war is decided by the people, not by one or two new types of weapons. So, in the face of American military might and the atomic bomb and so on, at a time when China didn't have it, Mao says, you know, the forces of this world are paper tigers. They look fierce, but they're really made out of paper. And history's on our side, and they're going to pass away. They're going to pass away like Hitler passed away, and the British Empire passed away, and so on. And we are going to triumph. We shall overcome. And so on. Now, you know, this is the belief that gives them their self-confidence and that also supports their patience. Now, I suspect you can be patient for a very, very long time if you keep on believing that eventually you're going to win. And the other guy, no matter how powerful he is, that sooner or later he's going to lose. And that one's enemies are paper tigers. Number two, topic of change. 203, Jim. There are two characteristics about change. One, it is inevitable, and more important, it is good. In other words, change to something new is good. Staying right where you are is bad. Going back to something you had before is bad. So novelty, by its very nature, is good. Take on 203, about half of it. Up to falsehood will never end.
You getting it, Tom?
Yeah.
The history of mankind is one of continuous development from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. This process is never ending. And any struggle in which classes exist, class struggle will never end. In classless society, the struggle between the new and the old, and between truth and falsehood, will never end.
Now notice there in the last sentence, in classless society. Now classless society is that communist perfect society where you don't need a state anymore. The struggle will go on. It's going to go on. Now, bottom 260, top 261, he says, opposition and struggle between ideas of different kinds constantly occurs within the party. Contrary to the Russian version, which was always monolithic in the official party line, nobody ever thinks, except the boys at the top. They issue the party line, and then you defend it. And you always got to watch it that you're always current, because they may do a sudden shift and you're defending the wrong party line. But the top decides what's right. What Mao is saying is there has to be a ferment of ideas within the party, certainly a more attractive idea than then you're told from the top what to believe, and you believe it and teach it. This is a reflection within the party of contradictions between classes and between the old and the new in society. If there were no contradictions in the party and no ideological struggles to resolve them, the party's life would come to an end. So there has to be. This is a sign of vitality. When you're arguing, comrades are arguing with one another about ideas, this is a sign of vitality. When they're all agreed with one another, the party's dead. So if there's peace and harmony and mainland shine and everything's going along very, very nicely, it's time to shake it up. We got to have some arguments. Or we don't come up with new ideas. We're going to pot. We're dying. Because the essence of life is change. And my watch says it's about time to change from here to drinking coffee and tea and milk. But next time we'll start with a very famous remark that there are two ways of bringing about change. And one is by diplomacy and the other is by guns. Sometimes you use the one and sometimes you use the other. You know, and diplomacy is the use, is the peaceful use of the gun, and the gun is violent diplomacy. But these are just simply two different sides of the same coin. These are two ways you bring about change. Okay, you've been very good.